Welcome to Streaming Into the Void, where we discuss all the streaming news for the week ending April 5th, 2024. I'm Kim Hollis, and I hate UConn. With me are Tim Bridie, content creator, gamer, and new WWE Universal Champion.
I finished the story.
Good for you. Also, David Mumpower, author of Behind the Ride and streaming media analyst, and someone bitter about the officiating in a certain Elite Eight game.
If someone is called for one foul and has 19 fouls committed against them, does that sound like even-handed officiating? I'm just going to throw that out there.
Spoilers, it was not. And the podcast is produced and edited by Raul Buriel, who's wishing for those quiet, halcyon days when he was organizing a conference.
There's going to be a reckoning on Monday.
Oh, that explains the earthquake today. Okay.
This week, Disney CEO Bob Iger goes medieval on his enemies, and Paramount's finally got a buyer. Let's start with Disney. The anxiety levels were rising over the last couple of weeks as the outcome of Disney's proxy battle with Nelson Peltz became cloudy. Investors took sides, and suddenly, Iger's victory over so-called activist investor Peltz seemed less of a foregone conclusion and more of a toss-up.
My favorite thing about everything we're about to discuss is after the last 3 weeks of our podcast going, I don't know, I think something's going to happen soon. It all happened this week, didn't it, Raul?
Oh, wow. Yes, a perfect storm of streaming and entertainment news. Yeah, in the last few days, some analysts were speculating that Iger should just compromise with Peltz and perhaps surrender one seat to him on the board rather than the two seats for which Peltz had been lobbying. Personally, I would argue that someone whose credentials as an activist investor are tenuous at best, is admittedly inexperienced in the entertainment field, and spouts racist and misogynist ideas should not be compromised with. Any Wall Street firm who said Peltz should be backed because it would be good for the company hasn't ever looked at Peltz's track record. But Peltz didn't push for two seats on Disney's board because he wanted to improve the company. David, what was the real reason Nelson Peltz wanted onto the Disney board?
Because Ike Perlmutter hates Bob Iger. And last year, Bob Iger defeated Nelson Peltz and also fired Ike Perlmutter. And you do not fire billionaires, ladies and gentlemen. That is just a bad career move. So we've had all of this personal animosity that's been brewing and brewing for the body of 2023 finally came to head at the start of 2024. And Peltz, after saying all along this wasn't about Bob Iger, when he actually voted, when he put his money where his mouth was, did not endorse Bob Iger, which is why you're hearing Bob Iger got 94% of the vote, which is absolutely true. More than half of the dissent, based on the information I have, came from Peltz and Perlmutter's votes alone. Think about that and how much animus it reveals about the entire situation. This was a waste of everyone's time from two greedy, egomaniacal billionaires, period. And to Raul's point, the day after the vote came out, the LA Times published an editorial about Disney should ignore everything Peltz suggested now that he's lost the vote. Their argument was he had no good ideas. Everything he was suggested was rancid. It was toxic. And it was intentionally acrimonious. And that is not what Disney should be about. Disney's improvements recently have made an impact. And they should keep staying the course there rather than going, well, you know, 30% of the people voted for Peltz, much, much less for Jay Rasselow. But that's a different conversation. So if 30% of the people liked what Peltz was saying, maybe we should give it more consideration. We have an author saying specifically, for the love of God, don't do that, because that's how out to lunch Nelson Peltz is. And I agree with the author.
So yeah, David, as you pointed out, Disney shareholders voted overwhelmingly to reject Nelson Peltz and his slate of board members. How did Bob Iger handle that?
So there's two aspects to this story. The first thing we should keep in mind is Peltz was a sore loser about it. He's going to be a sore loser about it. It's who he is. He went on CNBC after Bob Iger the following day, by the way, and he basically wouldn't rule out the fact that he would be back for a round three. And the reason why is this is a grift. We should never run away from the fact this is a financial grift in action, where Peltz was bragging on CNBC after the people estimated he might have made as much as $300 million. He took offense at that. And then the person guessed again and said, was it $1 billion? And he was like, oh, that sounds about right. He's a thief. We should never lose sight of what this scam is. But Iger knows that if the stock stays in the tank for an extended period, it'll happen again. And he also realized there was going to be tremendous profit taking as soon as the announcement was made that Peltz was gone from the conversation. And sure enough, that's what happened. The stock dropped a little bit. It was at 122, basically the day of the vote, and it was at 118 at the close of business on Friday. So to make sure that everybody realizes this is not a short-term gain and that Disney is on its way, several things happened all at once. While Bob Iger was on CNBC taking his victory lap and gloating, and he gloated, make no mistake on the point, while he was doing that, Disney was inviting journalists to a special projects report, something the company very rarely does, and they were basically saying, oh, and by the way, we already filed the paperwork to do stuff at Disney's Animal Kingdom, and we're filing the paperwork right now for that thing we promised in 2022, but we promised in air quotes, and that is we are building out Big Thunder Mountain. In other words, Magic Kingdom, the most popular theme park on the planet, is going to expand a lot in coming days. And on top of that, Disney went ahead and announced its release schedule, which we already knew for 2024. We had a good idea about 2025. Disney tightened up 2025 and then went ahead and announced it in 2026. And basically a 2-month period, they're going to do the live action Moana with The Rock. They're going to do Toy Story 5, which is a license to print money. And oh yeah, by the way, Memorial Day 2026, the Mandalorian and Grogu movie comes out, which means in about 2 months, Disney is going to absolutely wreck the box office. A friend of the podcast, David Parker, pointed out the fact that Disney has done something like this in the recent past, where around the time of Avengers Endgame, there was also Aladdin in another film. So sometimes they will just go ahead and line up all of their titles at once to dominate. That's what this is. So we feel good about Disney in 2024, at least as good as anybody can about theatrical releases. And then we know that that will have, you know, the sprinkle effects on Disney Plus and on streaming as it happens after the fact. And then 2025 looks good on paper. And also we learned that there is going to be a new Tron film coming out in late 2025. And now we found out that 2026 is absolutely stacked, at least on paper. So Iger has basically said, not only are we good right now, we're going to be great from now on, and they are not messing around. And that theme park expansion news doesn't technically apply to this podcast, but it really does show the fact that Disney was always waiting for two things, and that was for Nelson Peltz to go away and for the Florida feud nonsense to end.
Yeah, well, I think Iger's totally right to be flexing, but insisting that he be the starting center for Iowa's women's basketball team tonight, that's a bit much.
I don't know. I think that Caitlin Clark could get anybody open. Can't she, Kim?
Yes, I think she can. She can pass the ball to anyone, and she can shoot. She's got it all.
By the way, I guess we should just go ahead and throw in, that was the other flex that Disney is doing. 12.3 million people watched the Iowa-LSU women's basketball game, which at any point in my life would have seemed like an absolute impossibility. And you have to realize, folks, I have spent my adult life in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is basically the hotbed of women's basketball. Watching its popularity like this soar so quickly in such a short fashion, it's just otherworldly to me. It is. And just to be clear, more people watch this women's college basketball game than watched any game of the World Series and any game but one of the NBA Finals, any of the SEC or Big Ten football games this year. It was a staggering number. And oh, by the way, Disney recently locked up the rights to these college sports through 2031. Bob Iger is so far ahead of this, it's comical, and he does not get the respect he deserves.
Hotbed of women's basketball, unless you're a UConn fan, but we've established that they're not.
The moral of the story with Bob Iger is, when you come for the king, you best not miss.
And boy, did Nelson Peltz whiff on that one.
Nelson Peltz whiffed twice. And the best part is, there were two great things about it. He tried to do this New York Times puff piece, and it bit him so hard, where he sent the reporter a list of people who would give him positive references, all kinds of glowing things. None of them would speak on record. And when they did, it was like very tepid, yes, I've met Nelson Peltz stuff. That was the first thing. And the second thing was, after the vote, he had to read headlines of, this was the worst defeat of Nelson Peltz's career. Go away.
So next, we come to Paramount, who may finally be getting some good news. Variety revealed early in the week that the bid from private equity firm Apollo Global Management to buy Paramount was for $27 billion and would have included the entire company. Still, Paramount's head, Sherry Redstone, rejected it. But later in the week, the bid from Skydance to buy Paramount finally materialized, and it looks like Redstone is on board.
I mean, honestly, somebody shows up with $27 billion in a bag for Sherry Redstone, you'd think maybe she should have taken it. But look, one of the reported concerns with the Apollo offer as it was originally framed was that it would be only for the movie and TV studios, which would have left Redstone and parent company National Amusements holding the bag and heavily burdened with debt. An offer for the entire company, more importantly, a $27 billion offer, seemed like a much better deal. But as we've discussed before, because of the ownership structure of Paramount, it's a very complicated transaction. And Apollo was just at the starting line, while Skydance had been negotiating for some time. Evidently, the Skydance negotiations were very advanced, and it looks like they're going to win the prize in the end.
Yeah, and let's be clear, this is going to prove to be a good thing for Paramount Plus if this breaks the way this is trending. But there are a lot of ifs here. And the other thing I want to go back to, what Raul is saying, if anything, is underselling what just happened with Apollo. It's just manna from heaven. In theory, it was not anything fleshed out in any way. They suddenly realized, oh, wait, we have competition for the bid. Let's throw a large number at it. And maybe just maybe she'll go, oh, large number, I'll take that. Sherry Redstone's not an amateur. She's not an idiot. This is a very savvy executive here. This is not, you know, a Zaslavian situation. And even, you know, when I say Zaslav's stupid, he's not. Zaslav is a very smart man. He's just a con artist and somebody who's running a game that works very well for him specifically. Same deal with Sherry Redstone. Sherry Redstone wants to make sure she makes all the profit she possibly can from the businesses that Summer Redstone started. And that's where we're at with all of this. And when you look at what's happening right now. I joked to Raul the other day, but it's also not a joke. This probably reinforces the madness of everything we're discussing with streaming right now. Skydance got mad at Paramount a couple of years ago and went and cut a deal with Apple TV Plus for their films. In other words, right now, there is a chance that the person who buys Paramount Plus will be distributing their films on streaming via Apple TV Plus for a while because that contract's going to last. That's how bizarre all of this is, and there's no chance changing that. Just once you sign these deals, you have to stick to them. But at the end of the day, Skydance wants to be in the streaming media business. David Ellison has some of Larry Ellison's money and actually looks like just thus far a better entrepreneur overall, just a more competent person. And so we're getting to that point where he is going to own a media business. And as an operator, he seems to value streaming. And that's what we want to hear because we've said it over and over again. Paramount Plus is very well run. It's Paramount that's the problem. But Raul, I have to laugh at this just when we talk about it. We still don't really know who's right and who's wrong about the valuation of Paramount, do we?
No, I mean, if you just look at the stock price is absurdly low for a company that has as many assets as Paramount does. So the bottom line is just how much of a multiple over the current stock price is someone willing to pay. We don't know what the actual bid is from Skydance for Paramount yet. Presumably, it's going to be more than $27 billion. And what's more is on top of that, they're going to have to absorb the debt carried by Paramount at the moment, which is in the tens of billions as well. It's going to be a huge transaction any way you cut it.
Yeah. And the other thing we're witnessing is, you know, Michael Redstone founded this company in like, I don't know, I think it was like 1935, 1936, something like that. A lot of those contracts, believe it or not, kind of vestiges of them remain to this day. You're signing contracts in the 1960s that are still causing problems with a negotiation in 2024. That's the type of craziness that only happens in Hollywood, but here we are. And that's part of the reason why it was really hard for anyone like Apollo to come in off the street and start negotiating on an even keel with Skydance, who had already had the books opened up for them, at least some.
And to be fair, I would argue this is just going to be the beginning or another step in a long progression for this company, because Paramount, as David pointed out, isn't burdened down right now by Paramount Plus. Sure, Paramount Plus is presently a money loser, but it is going to become profitable sooner rather than later. It is burdened by a number of linear channels, mostly linear cable channels, that are becoming less and less valuable with every passing day. The argument here is that as Ellison presumably takes takes over Paramount, he's going to start spinning off or selling off those linear channels. It may well be that Byron Allen gets his BET at the end because he wanted BET, or someone else like Tyler Perry. But the truth is, those linear channels, and that includes VH1, MTV, even Nickelodeon, probably aren't going to remain under the Paramount umbrella much longer.
In other news, the old school digital studio Rooster Teeth, that's been killed by Warner Brothers Discovery, will release its last installment of Red vs. Blue as a digital movie, not to streaming, but to video on demand on May 7th.
It seems fitting that you wouldn't even be able to watch this on Warner Brothers Discovery streaming service Max. It speaks volumes about their streaming and corporate strategy.
This one hurts my heart. Thank you for all the entertainment, Bernie Burns. And you and Ashley Jenkins were a terrific, lovely tandem on The Amazing Race. I'm sorry you, like so many other talented contributors, got Zaslav'd.
So we are recording this a little early this week on Friday, so we'll catch up on box office next week. We'll just go ahead and get straight into the ratings. Tim, take it away.
We are looking at the Nielsen streaming ratings for Monday, March 4th to Sunday, March 10th, 2024. And this list is wild. We haven't had a week like this in quite some time. Maybe not the numbers, but just it's a bunch of mostly new stuff or things that make sense, at least. The top show, which I guess this doesn't make sense still, is Love is Blind. Another 1.5 billion minutes for 82 episodes. We got the, well, not quite finale on March 6th. One more episode of Reunion Special coming March 13th. So we'll probably see it again. I swear we've seen the show every time it has a new season. I said this last time, but I don't recall ever putting out this kind of number. So I don't know whether something wild happened this season or it's just got so many episodes now that people are just watching it and it's cumulatively just crushing it on Netflix. I have no idea. But new in second, with 1.2 billion minutes is The Gentlemen, 8 episodes. This is the Guy Ritchie series based on his movie that premiered on March 7th. So just a weekend number for the 8 episodes. David, you had said you had liked the source material of the movie. So you and Kim were looking forward to watching the series. Have you had a chance yet?
Yeah, we had a very, very busy week because of all the Disney stuff. But we thought the movie was charming. I mean, absolutely charming. Exceptional writing, absolutely exceptional. And so I fully understand why this would work really well as like a 2-minute preview. And I'm not surprised by the success of it, but I guess I am a little bit surprised by the scale. This is a bigger hit than I had anticipated, at least for what is a short week number, is what you're saying. Is this on the scale of what you were expecting, or is it more?
Definitely more. I did not expect this one to break out.
That's kind of where I'm at as well, but I'm also happy about it.
Yeah, I went back and listened to the What's New for that week, and everything new we talked about. So it was a pretty good week, at least for the ratings. But that's the top among the new shows this week. Third, Avatar The Last Airbender. That's been here a couple weeks now, 950 million minutes. So down after its huge numbers last couple weeks, but that's to be expected. 8 episodes from Netflix, of course. New in fourth, The Program, Cons, Cults, and Kidnapping, 901 million minutes for 3 episodes. This is a documentary series about what's called a behavior modification facility that was posing as a school, and people who were there talk about what happened. And apparently this is not the first documentary based on this particular example, or at least this seems to have happened quite often at these types of places, and that's just absolutely terrifying. The Tourist, also from Netflix, so they have the top 6 shows actually on the original chart this week. 763 million minutes. This was a BBC show that season 1 premiered in 2022, aired on Max. They dropped it, and then season 2 premiered in the UK in January, and then Netflix picked it up and it arrived on February 29th. So this is the full week for its second season. So just more Netflixing because they picked up something that Max dropped, and look what they did with it.
That gave me a headache. Prescribe me something, Tim.
Not legally. Furies, we saw that arrive last week in 524 million minutes, also from Netflix for 8 episodes. And in 7th, our first non-Netflix show, but this is Shogun, 382 million minutes for just 3 episodes.
So that clears up last week's confusion where it was just a typo after all.
Yes.
Or mistakes.
Premiered on the 27th and then the 3rd on 5th. It is weekly from here, but that's still a lot of minutes for just 3 episodes.
That's the thing. This shows signs of sustaining audience because you have to remember last week's number reflected 2 episodes. Mm-hmm. So it seems to have attracted more audience and sustained the one it had. So huge, huge positives here. I actually said something in an article that'll go live in a few days. My comment was, Shogun is intended as a limited series, but it would not surprise me if they found a way to sustain this brand because it has been that successful.
Yeah, there's 10 episodes in the season. It's going to run towards the end of April. So there's actually three more to go as we discuss this. But based on these numbers, this is going to hang around for quite a while. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a gigantic number as it approaches the end, as people either binge the whole thing after it's all out, or they get caught up in it just through word of mouth.
Based on what's happening right now, this joins The Handmaid's Tale, The Bear, and Only Murders in the Building as anchor content on Hulu.
Yes.
And the timing could not be better, because the Disney Hulu Plus tile is now official and permanent, which means from now on, whenever you use Disney Plus, you'll have a choice of Hulu content. And this is exactly the sort of content people should be watching.
Back to Netflix. In 8th, The Signal, 336 million minutes. This is a German series about astronauts and the International Space Station. We actually talked about this one too. And I was like, wait, did we mention it? Yes. Yes, we did. In 9th, returning to the list is The Traitors, 328 million minutes from Peacock, of course. And this is it's back because this was the finale of the second season. The final two episodes arrived on March 7th.
The other day, I was reading a thing from a Peacock executive that claimed that they had gotten their $110 million worth of the NFL playoff game that they paid for. In other words, they believe they have turned a profit on it. And while I question Peacock's accounting, because I've seen their books and they're dripping red, like, a scene from The Shining. Still, when I say that, I think about things like this. This is a huge win that such an inexpensive series is hanging around this long and growing the brand.
Yeah, this one definitely caught on with its second season, thanks to just being marketed when people subscribe to Peacock to watch a playoff game. And yeah, I think that will continue to pay dividends for them. People realize Peacock exists. And yeah, Netflix is the 900-pound gorilla, but they have some content worth watching. And oh, by the way, did you know The Office is on Peacock?
Is it though? If no one ever watches it, is it actually on a streamer?
We saw it once, so good enough for me. We saw it make the ratings once it left Netflix, so I'll allow it. Originals wraps up with yet another true crime documentary, American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders, 4 episodes, 327 million minutes. This premiered actually on February 28th, so it is the full week, but there's so much stuff on Netflix, people just do better. Really? Come on.
Not that it's all that unusual on the charts these days, but it's always encouraging to see that there is good and successful international content on the charts, and that includes Furies and The Signal.
Mm-hmm. Yep, The Furies is French, and yeah, The Signal is German, yes. Movies is led by Damsel, 1.2 billion minutes from Netflix. Wow. This is the Millie Bobby Brown vehicle that you guys said reminded you of what, Ready or Not?
Ready or Not meets Legend is how I would describe it.
This was premiered on March 8th, so yeah, this is just the weekend number, and that's outstanding.
To be fair, I compared it to Cabin in the Woods, and after watching it, I stand by my assertion.
This is not the first Millie Bobby Brown Netflix production. Of course, she's on Stranger Things, and she had the two Enola Holmes movies. Does she have like a contract with them? What's the deal there? Because she seems like she should be way more famous, but she keeps making a bunch of Netflix stuff.
If you were at Netflix and you hadn't finished Stranger Things yet, would you tell her no anytime she pitched you anything?
Good point. In second from Prime Video, Ricky Stenicki, 500 million minutes.
So a total bust and proof that 11 from Stranger Things could whip John Cena's ass.
Really, though, 500 million minutes on Prime? I mean, this premiered on March 7th, so it is most of the weekend. But when it's not Netflix, I'm usually pleasantly surprised to see things here. Well, then what does this make Wonka in third? Because this is on Max, 482 million minutes.
A sign that people are not engaged with Max content. This is a warning flare. It really is. Like, there should be sirens going off. No joke. There was a comment made the other day, and I actually put it in our Discord, that Jason Tyler said, one of the big signs about a streaming service is how much people are actually using it. Because what Netflix has mastered is people load Netflix and they go, hey, what have you got? You're not even loading Max if you're not watching Wonka. That's the reality of it. If you're subscribing to it and using the app, you have watched Wonka. If this cannot be, God help us, whatever Ricky Stenicki is, and I know it's a comedy, that's about the extent of it, but those two films together can't match Damsel. That's showing you right there the disparity in the industry that exists and the chasm that has to be crossed for these other services to become at least marginally competitive. Tim, I don't know how you feel. I'm saying a lot right now, but to me, this is the ultimate cautionary tale that Max is in real trouble.
Yes, absolutely. We only really see them, I mean, outside of House of the Dragon. And yeah, we did have True Detective a few weeks ago, but only when they have a season of, like, say, a prestige show running. That's when we really see them make a dent in these ratings. Outside of that, it's like their most watched show is Big Bang Theory. That's not a sustainable model because no one's watching their other content.
For comparison, and I realize that this is kind of a stretch and it's not apples to apples, but they estimated that almost 15 million people watched Wonder Woman 1984 when it debuted. We have just tracked throughout this podcast the gradual erosion of what they consider a strong performance. And that's why Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom kind of surprised us a little last week. At least it was better than, you know, we'd seen of some other titles, but still not good enough. You expect, based on that, Wonka, which was probably the biggest hit of December. Tim, I don't know if you agree or not. You can tell me. But what I consider the biggest hit of December, and it can't even match Aquaman. And I'm just like, what are we doing here? Is anybody actually using the Max app?
I'd agree with that. It wasn't a great box office holiday season, but Wonka was the winner from that lot. Yeah, if this is its debut on Max, and again, there are limitations to what Nielsen measures, but yeah, we joke about it, but the content that they've removed or they've sent to other streaming services, mostly Netflix, there is so little value in a subscription to Max, because really, what are you getting? Since you mentioned it, I'll skip one and throw in that Aquaman and Lost Kingdom is still here in fifth, 351 million minutes. We're predicting to not see it next week after it premiered on top last week.
It might have one more week, but that's because it just seems like 250, 200 to 250 is the cutoff, depending on how much people actually watch stuff. Mm-hmm. And with spring break factored in during some of these, we don't actually know what's happening at the time enough to estimate it. But it doesn't have staying power or legs, which means that what it gets in the first week is most of what it's going to get. I'm just... Tim, I don't mean to be pessimistic about Max, but you got to talk me into the fact that this isn't a nightmare.
No, this is not good. Yeah, the movie premieres should be doing way better than this. We talk about, okay, Bluey is the top show on Disney Plus, but they have all sorts of other content. You know, they still have the Star Wars content. They have the Marvel content. They have all the classic Disney movies. They have other things. When you're the thing most watched on your service is a sitcom that ended several years ago, and really nothing tends to top that. That's not good. Back to the list of movies. In fourth, Dune is still here, still credited to Hulu, Max, and Netflix, even though allegedly it's not on Netflix anymore as of March 1st. So I don't know what's happening there, but 375 million minutes. I'm actually expecting most of that number to come from Hulu then, instead of Max, because we know no one's watching Max. Though it does make sense that it is still here, because this was the weekend after Dune Part 2 was released. Maybe we won't see it again from here, because as far as we know, it's no longer on Netflix. Let's just fact check that. Yeah, Dune is no longer on Netflix, presumably as of March 1st. So good job, Nielsen. Way to keep up. The Super Mario Brothers movie is in sixth, 336 million minutes, of course, from Netflix. Spaceman, the Adam Sandler drama we saw abroad last week, 318 million minutes in seventh. New in eighth, Poor Things from Hulu, 318 million minutes for the Oscar-winning movie.
Yeah, for a change, a lot of the movies on this chart actually make a lot of sense.
Yes, right. Even the John Cena movie. That's right, David. I said it. Moana in ninth. So the Moana line is actually pretty hefty this week, 312 million minutes. And new in 10th. I guess this qualifies as the weird one, but I'll even still allow it just because of what it is. Turbo from Netflix, 252 million minutes. This actually arrived on Netflix on March 1st. Acquired is 10 shows we've seen before. As mentioned, led once again by Bluey, 1 billion minutes. Right behind it, the show we saw arrive last week, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, after its entire series arrived on Netflix. It's still also available on Peacock, of course. And of course, the original Avatar The Last Bender, or at least the animated series from the mid-2000s, is still here in eighth, Netflix, Paramount Plus. But we do have, you know, Monk, Suits, and Criminal Minds. So once again, the USA Network just continuing to crush it on the acquired chart. All right, that's all for the ratings this week. I'm just looking forward to the continued rise of Shogun. And yeah, this one was pretty fun considering some new shows to talk about, cleaning out some of the shows that had stuck around for quite a while. And Ricky Sinicky.
All right, as always, we close out the show with what's been keeping us busy over the last week, and I don't think I watched a single new thing. Did we, David?
No, I'll go ahead and say what we both did, and that's we've watched a lot of live sports, and
we have.
Kim, I know you agree with me. For all the criticisms that we do of Warner Brothers Discovery, there is something that has done so well, and that is the TNT broadcast of sporting events because nobody does basketball as well as them. And I include ESPN in that. We were so happy during every stage of the NCAA tournament because we were watching Candace Parker and Jay Wright talk basketball. And occasionally there'd be Clark Kellogg. Occasionally there'd be Charles Barkley. Occasionally there'd be Seth Davis. There's two different desks that are running at all times. And so there's all kinds of different conversations. It was just majestic, wasn't it, Kim? It was so convivial and enlightening and positive.
Yep, it is fantastic. I love watching all of the people that they have together talking basketball and just enjoying each other's company and respecting each other. There's just something really powerful about that when you're watching sports in addition to watching the games themselves.
And the other thing, the commentary was so good. Like Jay Wright, who obviously has won, you know, two national championships in the last few years, brilliant basketball mind, but he was like calling out, this is what's going to happen and this is why. And there would be like random upset type games, and he will have had the logic right on why one team was a matchup nightmare for someone else. And then when you watch Candace Parker, you just realize she has a beautiful basketball mind. And since, you know, she's in the conversation for greatest female basketball player ever, you can understand that. But it's only when she's talking that you realize just how much that skill translates across the board. We were so captivated, and whoever takes control of Warner Brothers Discovery down the road, I hope they treat these people right, because these are the ones that you can build a business around. I am not saying that hyperbolically.
All right, Raul, how about you?
So I'm going to tell you about From on MGM Plus, which I didn't watch, but my daughter did, and then proceeded to spend 3 days explaining it to me. She has described it as a complete knockoff and remake of Lost, which actually, when we announced From on MGM Plus season 2 previously on this show, I said, man, this looks like they just remade Lost.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it has one of the actors from Lost on it. That's Harold Perrineau. And it is literally the same premise as Lost, where in this case, a group of people find themselves in a small town, unable to escape the small town, and then mysterious things happen. And there's a number of plot points from Lost in there, right down to the other mysterious strangers that may be stalking them, the fact that those mysterious strangers may be trying to get their hands on the children of the people who are now stranded here, and yes, even a mysterious hatch in the ground. And for for season 2, those of you who remember Lost and the Tailies, yep, a tour bus full of people shows up in From, and now there's yet a second group of people that are now stranded with the first. It is, in essence, a remake of Lost, but according to my daughter, maybe they found all the errors in Lost and have corrected them and are addressing them by tightening up the plot. What's important to note here is that this production was actually filmed in Canada. To borrow a phrase from Tim, it does look like it might be, in fact, great value Lost, where they essentially have to cheap out on certain things. Oh, we can't get a tropical island, so instead we're going to film everything in a small Canadian maritime town. The fact that this show actually exists, much less that it exists on MGM Plus, that my daughter actually spent the 99 cents on Prime Video to subscribe to MGM Plus to watch it, is all hilarious to me. But well, she seems to have found it interesting enough to actually have watched it all the way through. But then again, she also took it upon herself to watch the full series of Lost all the way through at some point in her life. So I do question her decision making sometimes.
Now, for no apparent reason, I have the following numbers in my head. 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42.
That's weird. All right, Tim, what's been keeping you busy?
Well, let me talk about the thing that cost me a whole bunch of sleep this week. Just when you think there's no more room for innovation in the deck building game genre, along comes something so simple you wonder why the hell it took so long. Balatro is a deck building game that starts you out with a regular 52-card deck of playing cards, and your aim is to score points by making poker hands. You're not playing against other people, you just have a limited number of hands and discards to sculpt your hand to reach a target score each round, which of course are called blinds. Each level features a small blind, big blind, and then a boss blind. The required points increase each round, so to boost your score, you will need help from jokers, which aren't cards added to the deck, but instead cards that do things like increase the points for certain card values, suits or hand types, or other various effects that will boost your score. Defeating a blind earns you money where you visit the shop afterwards in order to purchase a randomized stock of Jokers that are offered, as well as other booster packs that offer enhancements that increase the base value of Poker Hand, add cards to the deck, or modify cards in the deck. So after a couple rounds and a few purchases, your starting deck will look nothing like a regular deck of cards. And by the end, imagine a deck that contains, oh, I don't know, 15 Kings of Diamonds. The bonuses you're offered also totally change how you play, because you can definitely end up with a deck where a pair will give you way more points than, say, dropping like a straight. And there's even a Kai card build in there somewhere, depending on what's offered for you. You need these buffs because not only do the scores required to defeat the blinds rise rapidly, the boss blinds also change the rules, such as blanking an entire suit, making them worthless, limiting you to one hand type during the entire round, or not allowing repeat hands, or just straight up lowering the points that you get for each hand. This game is brilliant. There's all sorts of unlockables that open up more Joker selections on future runs, and of course, difficulty modifiers if you're just a complete masochist. There is 100% a one more run aspect to this game, and oh god, did it absolutely cost me a good night's sleep more than once this week. It's overwhelmingly positive on Steam, 97% positive reviews. It's $15. I almost want to say, don't buy this game if you value things like sleep, because it will just take over your life for quite some time. But this game is amazing.
All right. Thank you for listening to Streaming Into the Void. Please consider subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts, and we welcome your feedback. Remember that we're on social media at Streaming Void and online at streamingvoid.com. If you like what you're hearing, please consider becoming a supporter on Patreon at patreon.com/streamingvoid. Be sure to watch for us again next week.